Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guests today are...
Hello, I'm Caroline Mitchell. I'm Professor of Radio and Participation at the University of Sunderland, which is in the northeast of England.
Hi,
Hello,
Caroline.
My name is Evi Karathanasopoulou. I am a principal academic in audio production at Bournemouth University in the UK. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Thanks, Evie.
I'm Katie Moylan. I am Associate Professor of Media at the University of Leicester, so also based in the UK. And I have an ongoing interest in community radio and in the radio form and radio aesthetics, which is why I was very excited that you guys are joining me so we can kind of unpack these ideas as they relate to this thing called podcasting and what even is podcasting. That's a bit of a segue. Over to you, Toby.
And Katie, thank you so much for organizing this. I really appreciate it. So folks, before I take a step back and try to control the podcat and sip my English breakfast, I wonder if I could ask each of you to share with us a little bit about what is currently dynamizing, retarding, exciting, preoccupying, interesting you.
Yes, so Caroline here. What is occupying me at the moment? So many issues, but in terms of why I'm here, I feel a little bit of an imposter being in podcasting, but I find myself in podcasting a lot. I'm making podcasts a lot. I'm involved in podcasts at the moment. And what I seem to be doing is bringing my practice of community radio and methods that I've developed over many years of making inclusive community radio stations and programs, I seem to be bringing that in to podcasting. And I'm really excited about that because, as we all know, young people, for instance, in particular, are moving away from radio, although they do come back sometimes. And but they are really into podcasting. In fact, everyone as audiences seem to be into podcasting in UK. People who you wouldn't really necessarily expect to be into podcasting. And so in the work that I'm doing, which is predominantly with communities in Sunderland, it's a large city in the northeast, post-industrial, all sorts of issues. It was the first city to vote for Brexit. It is full of interesting contradictions around cultural life and the influence of the past on the present. And I've spent the last, I started working in Sunderland in the early 90s, and I've spent all this time helping people get on air in some way, and therefore voicing the concerns they have in their own voices, in their own terms. And I think podcasting is a really good way for people to do that. And particularly post-COVID, people are sort of tuned in to listening to podcasts in different ways. And even, some of the people you wouldn't really expect to be listening, necessarily because of their age, for instance, are finding podcasts quite easily, and they are listening to them, and they are relating to them. So that's sort of what's occupying me. And I'm actually involved in making... I've just launched a podcast series called Rebel Women of Sunderland, Rebel Women of Sunderland, which is a project that's been going on for a while as really wonderful, as a creative arts response to uncovering hidden women in Sunderland, whether they are journalists, politicians, activists, shipyard workers. And they started off as a poster and a website. And about 6 months ago, we started thinking about, could this be a podcast? So We have just launched the first three of Rebel Women of Sunderland. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. And we have found a way, I think, of not doing podcasts in a kind of rebel woman person by person way. We're thematizing them and looking at rebel women in music, creative writing, and sports. And we've found a way of making those podcasts to celebrate the women in our wonderful series, but also to actually bring particular audiences to the podcast and make the podcast in places where outside the university. Although, so I've been doing that, and I'm also about to start a podcast next week, which completely different, but it involves people in Sunderland and their heritage. We are making a podcast called The Ballad of the Crocodile and the Underpass. And you heard that word ballad, which is a wonderful word, and people in radio studies will know it and maybe remember it from the radio ballads of Charles Parker, where he was making programmes in the 50s and 60s about working class culture and jobs, including up here in Sunderland, about the coal industry, the fishing industry, and so on. And we are now, we've just got funding to make a podcast with people in the new town of Washington, which is a 60-year-old new town in Sunderland, or on the edge of Sunderland. And we are making a participatory podcast with them that starts next week. And there I'm working with a sound artist and musicians, and we're looking at ways of portraying the journey of this new town in ballad form, and a new ballad form. So I'm very excited about that as well. So if I'm also very aware, my colleague is someone who's very well known in the area of podcast studies, Richard Berry, Dr. Richard Berry, who I've known all my working life. I appointed him, I think, a very long time ago. And so I feel, you know, he's sitting on my shoulder in some ways, because I've obviously learned a lot about podcast studies and from him. Yes, so I think that's enough of me to start with. I've got plenty of other things on my mind, including climate change. But anyway, let's, and that's another podcast.
Thanks, Caroline. Could I invite Evie now to chime in on what's currently dynamizing, preoccupying, blah, blah, blahing you?
Yeah. So when you asked about what's concerning us earlier, climate change was the first thing that also popped into my mind. But I feel like it's too big a thing to talk about. Although I have to say that in my education activities, we do try and introduce students to sustainability and working sustainably as media practitioners. So I suppose there is something that we could talk about as educators. But in terms of the here and now, I come from radio studies myself. My PhD was in radio studies, and I am actually finding myself writing about podcasting more and more and more. I'm nowhere near where Richard Berry is, who to me is the godfather of podcast studies, at least for us here in the UK. But what I do find as I write about podcasting more and more is that the main interests that I have remain the same. So intimacy is one, and things like imaginary space is another. So the connections to architecture. So the themes sort of tend to remain the same, which I think is interesting. And I do think that for anyone listening interested in the theory of things, I think that podcast studies cannot really exist without radio studies. And I think these two areas, it's very important to always remember how strongly connected they are and how they feed off each other. That's, I guess, where I'm at. I mean, there's so much to say if we're gonna explore any further, but yeah, that's it for now, I'd say.
Thank you, Evie. And finally, Katie, before things move into you guys interacting about in the radio podcast SmackDown.
Okay, yeah, because that sets them up as a binary, which I would actually contest. But like Caroline, I never think of myself as a podcast scholar. There are so many great podcast scholars out there. Richard Berry, of course, is one. I'm thinking of Kim Fox as another. And Evie, of course, is delving into it herself, too. And then Caroline's making them. So I don't do any of those things. But if you study radio, if radio is something you research, you can't help but be aware of podcasts. And, you know, kind of widening back out, zooming back out for a second, if you're asking what's preoccupying me, you know, whenever you teach, I think, especially if you teach anywhere in the discipline of media studies or cultural studies, you're always teaching and navigating the current moment. I mean, we do anyway, but I feel like we have the capacity to discuss this more sometimes in our classrooms because of the nature of our disciplines. Sociology too, of course, right? So we just finished our teaching semester, and part of my teaching includes a community radio module where our students produce programs for the community station, Leicester Station, Eva FM, and VJ, of course, was on this podcast some weeks back. So in their radio shows, they work in groups and they self-define what community of listeners they want to address their live two-hour show to. And in their shows, they really kind of navigate their subjectivity. And that, to me, connects back to the capacities of radio and community radio. And it's you know, the way that it can be used to express elements of our everyday life, because it itself is an everyday medium. So then that always sits alongside these other capacities of radio that Evie mentioned and that Caroline mentioned. So radio's capacity to reproduce a sense of locality, to really make you feel like you are situated in a particular geographical, but maybe also emotional place, you know? And also the sense of intimacy that has always been characteristic of radio when it was broadcast, when its default was broadcast live. There's plenty of live radio out there, but as is not necessarily anymore the default. So I'm thinking of the current moment. I'm thinking of marking my students' work and their radio shows, but I'm also thinking of this conversation that we're having and the kind of like Venn diagram, as it were, of podcasting and radio. And what defines and determines what each is. And podcasting has become so popular. So it makes sense that we use this, I would call emergent form, you know, to amplify otherwise underrepresented voices, which is some of the work that Caroline's doing. So maybe we can take it from there. I don't want to say one's better than the other, but they do have different affordances.
I'm nodding. I'm not.
I know, yeah, and I'm all like, next.
In a very radio way, a radiophonic way.
We all
way.
Nod at each other over our microphones. It's so true.
Going back to the students, I'm working with students at the moment on our masters, which 3 or 4 years ago, we renamed radio, audio and podcasting. And each year we expand the work we're doing on podcasting and teach alongside radio studies. And although we do have mature students on our master's course who have a lifetime history of radio listening, increasingly the students who we have who, you know, are coming to us straight from graduating or with just 1 or 2 years between graduating from their BA in whatever they're doing to doing our masters, are coming to us listening very little to radio. And I sort of see podcasting as a sort of gateway to radio. And it's really interesting because with the BBC, who have pretty cleverly got a really great sort of platform, BBC Sounds, for a whole range of different programs. Sometimes students say to me that they listen to this podcast on BBC Sounds, and I am able to point out to them that that is also a radio program. So it's like podcasting is bringing students to radio, but that doesn't mean to say they are going to switch on a radio and listen to it like that. They are listening via BBC Sounds, and as I say, I think it is it thank goodness for BBC Sounds. It brings people to radio. The other thing is that when I'm talking, when I'm teaching with Richard and others, when we're teaching all sorts of techniques, for many students who don't listen to that much radio, they're really interested in the aesthetics, the storytelling, the forms of what they see as podcasting, and we are then able to sort of build back, if that's the right word, you know, for instance, the ballad, you know, the ballad format. We can talk about that. That's quite unusual in podcasting. But what is interesting at the moment for me is that students love audio drama, radio drama. And it's like they're, you know, we had years where we were actually worried that we wouldn't be running our radio drama module. We've got lovely facilities, and but actually people now, young people, are coming to the course with an interest in audio drama because of gaming and storytelling that way. They are really loving the, and because of film. You know, they love stories and soundscapes around those stories. And so I'm still quite gobsmacked by the fact that we're teaching audio drama and podcasting, because that's how people will end up receiving those programs when they're made. So I think it's a really interesting time to be teaching both radio studies, podcast studies, radio practice, podcast practice. That's where I've just come to the end of that little bit, and I'm very happy to talk about that. But
that's
I'm not
interesting,
hearing
Caroline. Going back to education, and I teach audio production to undergrad students, particularly who come to a media production course, so they're expected to learn the basics to start with of all media. And so often the audio production unit that I do with them for first year is the first introduction they have to the subject. Most of them will have, as they say, watched podcasts on YouTube, and a lot of what I do is sort of the unlearning of the watching and the starting for them to think about listening. What I am learning as an academic is that it might be that the future is more sort of complex than that. I've recently wrote something that I've sent in for approval. Let's see if it gets approved. But I had discussions about it with Richard Berry as well, and I do think that the visual might be something that we might have to accept as part of podcast practice, not necessarily as primary and not necessarily as it always being there, but maybe as part of the equation. And that's something I think we many of us will need to grapple with. And, you know, as audio purists, I think many of us are. So the thing that I've written is about the use of VR, potential use of VR in podcasting. I think, yeah, Katie might know a little bit about that, because we spoke about it before. But as I was writing that, what interested me was that some of the primary elements of what we consider audio practice and audio listening remain. So I do think intimacies remain. They just have a different form or a different feel. And the idea of placing yourself into a, say, imaginary place or imaginary situation also persists, which I think is very, very interesting. So I think it might not be as grim as sometimes we feel it is when students say, oh, I watched this podcast on YouTube and that's all they, you know. And I mean, I can talk about that more later if you guys are interested in this.
I mean, I think that's the case, right? Where, I mean, I always have to remind myself, you know, we meet our students where they live, right? And where they live with radio or what they perceive as radio and where we're coming from with radio tend to be quite different. And it's not just generational. It is the case that they don't see radio as radio, or if they do, it's because they listen to it in their parents' cars or sometimes their own cars, in these older analog ways, or they learned it with their family. But I love these questions about the evolution of radio, and because I'm always interested in these first principles, which we just have to keep at this very interesting moment in time, as you say, Caroline, deconstructing for our students, but for ourselves too, as we develop our scholarship, you know. So an example, incorporating the visual into, you know, a question, is this radio? Something I wrote about, or I'm writing about in my book to come, is an interaction I had with a community radio program produced by WHIV. That's Mark Alon. He's the manager for that. And he spoke again on this a couple of weeks ago. So they did a show called Noise Filter, which is an innocuous kind of name, but it spoke from the beginning of the lockdowns, at the beginning of the pandemic. And he's a doctor. So they talked about common sense. They talked about being healthy. They talked about protocols, mask wearing, et cetera. But they also talked about things like when you're on protest marches, how to be safe and how it feels to be in the Black Lives Matter moment of that summer of 2020. And they were coming very much from New Orleans. So it was a very, very place-based program. But the reason I mention it here is because it was streamed on Facebook Live, which I found fascinating, because a lot of community stations do use Facebook Live, and Facebook Live has that visual component. So it's like very localized, very place-based, historically under-resourced radio programming on Facebook Live, which immediately elevates it. It doesn't elevate the content, but it changes the form. Well, does it change the form? Because Facebook, of course, is this immensely problematic, contested, exploitative platform. Yet it is useful for community stations, and it does incorporate this visual element. So it all transformed, because what also happened is we were all tuning into this in real time. So that was 4 p.m. in New Orleans time. I was accessing it from my own lockdown in the Peak District at 10 p.m. So I usually got to bring a glass of wine whilst listening, because we were all doing this in real time, and we're commenting, and some people were sick, and they're saying, how did you get sick, and how are you coping, and what are you eating, and Jazz Fest is remote, what are we feeling about that? And it was just so deeply intimate, at political levels, social levels, everything. And the visual element, I mean, the guys, the two presenters, the two doctors, had muted their backgrounds. So it was nice to see their face, but in a way, it still very much felt like live radio, because to me it was, but on this platform. So I guess anyway, as an example of ways in which these affordances combine and bush up, you know, crash up against each other, and still these kind of values of radio, these qualities, which I love, the intimacy, the feeling connected in real time, were there in these moments of broadcast. But I also see the value in but, and I don't mean to say but as a contrast or as a contradiction, but podcasts also very much give space to marginalized voices. And you were talking about that, Caroline, as well. And arguably they do so more and more thoroughly. What do you guys think? I mean, do you think podcasts enable self-representation of groups which otherwise do not go on air? That's my feeling alongside community radio.
I think yes and no. I think I've just been, my work started off very much about women and radio. That was the sort of area I started off in, and both doing practice in setting up women's stations, but also so writing about all sorts of aspects of women's voices being invisible and what were the barriers and the issues around that. And even though I sort of left that work a while ago to do other things, it keeps on coming back. And I'm at the moment writing a chapter about looking at new ways of researching women, women's involvement in radio. And what I'm saying is that podcasting is a platform that many women are finding a lot easier to access than traditional radio stations. You want to do a program, you set up a group, you do a podcast. However, if you look at some of the studies in who is doing podcasting and the most successful ones, of course, we're seeing the same kind of inequalities in how many women are doing podcasting. But it is perceived as a platform that women can access more easily. And I think we've seen that, for instance, with producers who are making work as independents for the BBC, that setting up companies on their own terms, that there are some really interesting examples now of women making programs together and making podcasts together. I remember listening to Helen Zaltzman, talking, I think it was one of the early Sound Women, one of the Sound Women conversations that we were having. Sound Women was an organisation for around 6 or 7 years that was mainstream industry activism for women in radio. And I remember her saying, Helen Zaltzman is a producer and a podcaster, and she was saying for years she was banging on the BBC door to with programme ideas, and they were, the door was closed. And so she set up a podcast. This is in the early days of podcasting. And it became quite popular. And in fact, she was touring it in America, I think. And suddenly the BBC was saying, actually, we want you now. We want you now. So it maybe is. And I think she said, I don't know quite how she said it, but I think she said, no, thank you. But because she was doing more interesting things. But I think it is being it is initially more accessible. And it is a way of women. So if you like, it's lots of little community radio bubbles, you know, but women are doing some really interesting things, I think, and talking to each other in podcasts and breaking lots of taboos around subject matter. I think, you know, if I talk to my students, what is the most popular podcast that they all listen to? Can you guess? Well, it's Joe Rogan, of course, they are really fascinated by his fame, his influence, his sort of his platform. And of course, that is a visual. That is also a televised, video thing. So the second thing I was going to say about, you were talking about Facebook Live, and of course that is not available to licensed stations in the UK usually. They usually get told that, you know, it's, in fact, from our own experience, we have a licensed community station in Sunderland, and I'm pretty sure that we are not necessarily able to use Facebook Live because of licensing and rights issues, and I think we're told not to use it. What is being used in terms of podcasts, and I have had some really interesting discussions recently about this new podcast I'm involved in, is that we're assuming that everything will go on YouTube, because that is the platform of the free platform of choice, and if we want it heard, we have to realise that as well as, you know, carefully, you know, something we've got, we subscribe to a good podcast platform, and then it's linked to all the other platforms where you can get your podcast, whether it's Spotify or wherever. But actually, most people in our locality will not necessarily have the income to subscribe to those things, not necessarily, and will be using YouTube. So we're thinking of how we can frame our listenership via those kind of platforms.
I was really interested, Caroline, about your discussion about how marginalized communities use radio and podcasting specifically now. I recently wrote an article with Helen Williams from Sunderland Uni, actually. And I was saying before the podcast started that I'm an eternal student of Caroline. So we quote Caroline in that article, but it looks at podcasting as a feminist space for disclosure of trauma. And specifically, we're looking at the heart as a place for quiet activism. And we looked at this series No that Caitlin Press did, which is about consent, where she discussed her own relationships and trauma that she's had over the years. And I do think that a program like Caitlin Prest's could only be made as a podcast. I think it would be very hard to broadcast that on live radio or on broadcast radio because of the differences in compliance and audience expectations and what we deem sort of broadcastable. Because there is content there, you know, where that recreates sexual contact, as well as I think some actual audio from sort of intimate discussions between partners or ex-partners. And so in that way, I would say that podcasting definitely is a unique space for, I would say, women and other marginalized communities to be able to do activism and create safe spaces to discuss these things. And I do think that is a very important element today. I mean, we've had horrible femicides in the UK. I am from Athens, Greece, where we've had a just shocking, no words, femicide that happened outside a police station where the woman had gone to ask for help and they didn't help her and they let her walk out of there and she was stabbed to death. So these are issues that we need to be able to tackle safely, and whether we're going to be able to make a difference, I don't know, but I do think that podcasting allows us that space maybe. But again, I'd like to hear from Caroline because, like I say, I think you are the when we talk about women and radio / podcasting, I think you are the whiz.
I'm sort of reeling a bit from your description and how that happened and I think in community radio and women's radio, those spaces are there. They've often been sort of what I call the after midnight, the non-mainstream time or the non-mainstream stations. I was doing a lecture about women's radio archives fairly recently, and I've been exploring the Pacifica archives. They've had significant funding to look back at the archives and place it online. And there was an extraordinary discussion in the late 60s on KPFA, I think, where there was a consciousness raising session on air of a group of women and talking about housework. It was actually quite cringing to listen to now. You know, people really getting tangled up in that age-old discussion about who does various bits of the housework. But it was an extraordinary insight into a live discussion, and it was almost like consciousness raising on air. And I think community radio has always had interesting spaces for non-mainstream, and we just don't necessarily know about them, and they're often hidden in the schedules in very specialist spaces, and it was in that case a feminist program, but sometimes they're hidden in as I say in the early hours when things can be discussed without worry about young ears listening or ears that shouldn't be listening and so on. So I think they've always been there, but I think what is interesting now is that listeners are when they're listening to a podcast, those constraints of scheduling and time, you know, aren't there, and I think that's where you get some as you I think said, Amy, this sort of slower, quieter, more analytical discussion, and having a longer time to kind of address subjects and more depth that just, you know, isn't allowed for in any schedule on a busy radio station. But as I said, I think some radio stations, they're designed. I mean, if you think about Resonance FM in London, a long-term community station that values experimental work and sound work and all sorts of marginalized work, so it's always been there, and they, you know, Resonance, when they first started in London, prided themselves on not having the usual boundaries of news on the hour, having an hour-long program. You know, they had I think they still have a slot called Clear Slot, which can be programmed however you like and so on. But the schedules are very, very dominating, aren't they? They're very dominating. And you know, in all our courses, at one moment we're teaching, you know, experimental stretching audio spaces. And the next moment we're talking about commercial, you know, how you schedule the flow of commercial radio with ads and links and that, not breaking that flow, not having any of those silences that make people stop and think about what they're listening to. So in that way, podcasts, you know, are we seeing, you know, podcasts, you know, there's plenty of research to be done about the space of the length of podcasts, for instance. What do people listen to? But I certainly, personally, as a listener, love getting lost in podcasts. I quite often listen to a favorite radio program, knowing that there will be a podcast that's longer. You know, sometimes I listen to it live at the time. Sometimes I go back and listen, and I really enjoy the longer length of those programs. So, yeah, I'm going back to the space for women. I think podcasts are affording this new way of you know, a new, is it a new power? Is it a new space that is longer, broader, you know, easier for women to experiment in, to occupy?
I mean, I can't, that's the important thing, you know, a safe space for thorough exploration of these ideas that are important, that people can tune into as they need it, and in a way, any community facing radio or podcast, that's its job, that's its work. I keep trying to lie the binary between the two, because I don't think they're binary things. But for me, I was always struck by community radio's capacity, though, also for that live discussion and navigating of of hurt, but also providing care, you know? And so that example you gave, Caroline, was really, really resonated for me. I'm thinking, you know, I got into studying radio because I was living in Dublin in like the 2000s, and Ireland, unlike the rest, this is relevant, sorry. Ireland had late inward migration compared to the rest of Western Europe, which meant that its public sphere, its public broadcaster, RTE, its version of the BBC, as it were, its national broadcaster, wasn't really negotiating diversity very effectively or well, or in any nuanced way, but its community radio stations were. And the first radio program that galvanized me into looking further into community radio was on a community station called Anna Livy FM. And that was hosted by, I can see them, but I don't, anyway, a Nigerian producer-presenter and a producer-presenter from South Africa. And they were talking about being new migrants in Dublin and talking very frankly about the discrimination that they were combating and how difficult it was and the insults they're experiencing, but bringing their own perspective and talking amongst themselves strategies, you know, for navigating in Ireland that didn't have any history of inward migration and wasn't negotiating it well. And that to me showed me what that space of community radio could do. And I guess for me, a strength of that, I think it's really important and interesting to compare the different spaces, because on the one hand, the podcast space isn't subject to regulation in the same way. So you can go deep into the topics as deeply as you need to discuss them in the depths that they warrant. Whereas all radio, community radio included, has remits. It is regulated. So there's all kinds of things that it has to. It's not a very censored space. It never feels a censored space, but it does have to adhere to live broadcasting regulation. But I still think there's capacity there too. I'm thinking of WHIV's, again, activist programming, but also of a station in Hawaii from the university there, KTUH. And I've heard some amazing, caring programming coming from students there where they talk about struggles and trauma and identification of all kinds of different subjectivities. And I feel like it's very important political programming, you know? So I love, I guess the most important thing, isn't it, that there's greater spaces. There are more spaces out there for expressive people expressing their experiences where they're not heard still in the mainstream media, as we know. So there are more audio spaces, and if they involve a visual component, that's alongside these other considerations. But maybe the most important thing is that they enable this space to unpack really important ideas and share experiences. So really just agreeing with the two of you with many sentences.
I think the element of time is key to a lot of the discussion we've had, and in many different ways. Like Caroline was saying, obviously the podcast is not sort of chased by the broadcast clock, and also you can do longer shows without worrying about scheduling. I think the other thing in terms of time that we might find becomes important in future in terms of live radio and podcasting might be how we preserve. Obviously, we preserve a lot of radio, and we have a lot of radio from decades past. But podcast by its nature is something that we save into different places. And so it's got more potential to be saved and kept for future generations. And as Helen and I were writing about Prest's No series in the Heart, something that we were thinking about was the potential for oral history there, and for a very intimate sort of caption of feeling of the time, and how that might be preserved for the future and be listened to in the same way as it was listened to at the time. So the mode of listening doesn't change. Nobody's listening to it live or broadcast. It was always there as a podcast. I'm not sure if does Heart of the Heart ever get broadcast on radio in the US. I'm not aware that happens, but that would be something to look to look at. I hope I'm not wrong. But yeah, I do think if we're trying to sort of come up with, and that's what I was trying to do in this latest thing that I've been writing, come up with an ontology of the podcast and sort of its very sort of essence. I think there is something to be said there about it being almost like a ghostly sort of thing that somebody might be able to record in, you know, thousands of years in some old hard drive, and then be able to connect with people as they're recording in their intimate spaces. And a lot of podcast recording does happen in sort of domestic spaces. So I know this is a bit out there, but it's something that I do think about. I don't know. How does the... Yeah.
Well, no, I want to jump in there, but I don't know. I didn't want to cut you off, Evie. Okay.
No, please. I want to hear from you and Caroline.
I want to give Caroline space, because what you're talking about, you know, lends me to think about the archive. And archiving is something that a lot of people in radio studies as a discipline have always talked about. But also talking about the podcast in this way brings us back to the question of form. And that's always how I start and end thinking about podcasts, because they are outside of what my expertise or knowledge, I should say. So I have to look at them as form. That's my way of understanding them. And so I think of them as this downloadable thing. But as you describe them, they very much lend themselves to the archive, to being archived, to kind of like from the very beginning comprising an element of the archive rather than going back, because creating the archive, that overused word curating, but, you know, composing an archive is always a political act too. You know, what do you select? You have selection criteria, and that itself has its own hierarchies. But if the mode of podcasting already de facto, I know that's reductive, but de facto puts itself in an archive, what does that mean for like further future archiving practice? So that's actually quite exciting to me. So I'm happy to follow you further down that tangent. Caroline, what are you thinking?
Yeah, I think, pre-podcasting, when I first started looking at archives, there was a really great European project called Capture, which was about living archives. And as soon as I thought about archives as living, I got really excited by it. And we've heard lots of examples of archives being lost and found. And one of the main things I learned when I was working on the Transnational Radio Encounters project, which Katie, you were also involved in, one of the core things that Peter Lewis and I found was that in community radio stations, everyone kept their own archives, because community radio stations, unless they had to archive for, you know, compliance reasons, and that was usually for only a particular period of time, they just didn't have the time to keep things. And so what seemed to happen, and I did this myself, I still do, is when I made a program, or when someone made a program, they would take a cassette copy of it. And I'm talking about old cassette media here, but, or they would take a copy of it somehow, and then they would put it on a shelf. And then, of course, what we realized when we were talking to Transnational and various broadcasters is they had these little archives. And what we were interested in doing is talking to them about how to kind of exchange those programs with other people and make use of them. And then this parallel project that was going on, Capture, I think it was led in Germany. The whole idea that archives could be played with and used again, reused. Fantastic example, radio student in Ljubljana, is it? Am I right? Radio student isn't a student radio station. It's a community station. It's called radio student. And I remember hearing about how they used their archives. And what they used to do is they probably had a sort of vague archive in the radio station of tapes, cassettes. And what they used to do is choose an old tape, play it on air, and then talk about it in the programme. And I always thought that was great. And it was sort of looking back, but also bringing it into the present studio. And I really like the idea of, and this is what we're beginning to explore with this concept of the radio podcast ballad, is how archive material can be incorporated into current day podcasts and how people connect then with that. And that's what we will be exploring over the next few months in this crocodile program. These were concrete crocodiles produced by the local authority to draw people into the new shopping centre. And people do have memories of those crocodiles. But what we're also interested in doing, so the crocodile is going to be on the image of the podcast, you know, the publicity for the whole project. But what more than that, what we're getting people to do is talk in, you know, their own stories about their memories of this 60 years of this development of this new town. So, and we are going back to some of the archives, you know, and we're finding new archives, as I said, per people's personal cassettes. But there will be other archive material. For instance, Nissan is also based in Washington, and it's on the edge of Washington. A lot of people who live in Washington worked for and still work for the car company Nissan, and it was part of the regeneration of that area. So what can we now do with some of that, you know, the sort of old, not that old, only 60 years old max, but, you know, we will be able to play quite nicely with the sounds there and some of the old interviews and also hear people. It's multi-layered, this. It's really interesting to, for me as a researcher, to be watching this process of making a heritage-based program with particular groups, and to see how people do engage. We're doing a very traditional thing to reach out to people. We're having a roadshow. I mean, we're going out with sounds and archive material and playing it in shopping centres and in different groups to then get a response and to record then and there the responses. So we are creating a sort of living archive roadshow. Anyway, I don't know whether I'm going too far down my little heritage podcast rabbit hole, but I do think that and it's obviously to do with my age as well, I am fascinated by archives, but I want to make them relevant, and I don't want them to be just a nostalgia fest of looking back. I'm really interested in them being a kind of grit in the oyster, you know, to get people thinking about the past, the present, the future, their relationship with sound, their relationship with stories, and to create new stories themselves anew.
So activating the archive, basically using it
living
as a provocation.
Archives activating,
But that also sounds like a way to just kind of remind ourselves of all these capacities of sound, and the way that there's this idea when we look back in history that people were like differently articulate or something, you know, these kind of shibboleths we carry about stuff in the past, and kind of like listening to older radios, the perfect way to just turn that on its head.
Sorry, but in the past, didn't want to jump. In the past, though,
yeah,
we did not hear so much variety of voices. There was a definite prejudice, exclusion, for right. instance, of accent, accented voices, of voices that were difficult to listen to for a mainstream audience who only had a very limited range of received pronunciation, etc.
Right.
So I suppose actually delving into non-broadcast oral history archives, that's where they stayed. They used to stay in an oral history non-broadcast place, maybe picked out occasionally, a little cherry picking. but what we're, I think we're trying to turn that on its head a little bit now.
You know, that's true. I reviewed an article for a journal where somebody was mining archives. And it's again, it goes back to this idea that the archives are the recognition that archive being is a political thing, and where past programming, you know, oral history versus actually on air in the BBC, for example. So as ever, I think we're running into lots of different tangents, which is great. How much time can we, Evie, did you want to jump in?
I was just going to say, just on what you just said, that again, this is very, very speculative. But if we're looking at the far future, and we're talking about archive and we're talking about podcasting versus live radio, where, you know, archive there sits within sort of institutions, and is probably, you know, gatekeeped, maybe. In terms of podcasting, somebody could mine podcasts by themselves. So again, there is a more democratized process of, if somebody 200 years in the future wanted to, they probably could find old podcasts somewhere on the network, or somewhere in some device that's been left behind. So again, I think we're going into a space that is more open for people who might not have had that access before. Very speculative.
But it's still preoccupying ourselves with these ongoing questions around radio and around podcasting, around access, you know, and who gets to access what. Because alongside that, what often strikes me about getting to podcasts in my own listening is things like subscription, you know, wherever you get your podcast. And then I see the Apple thing and I'm like, yeah, no, because just on principle. And I take your point on YouTube, and I think it's important that that podcasts are as accessible as possible. So what can be done to ensure that, and to ensure that Evie's future, where things are not siloed, where they are widely, where there is a mosaic of sound communities, that people can access as they need to. What needs to change in terms of platformatization, to address that? No small questions here, obviously.
Yeah, I haven't got the answer, but I mean, my immediate thought, and I could be wrong, is that we're seeing the industry jumping into this whole thing very quickly because there is money in it, obviously. And I'm seeing a lot of attempts to put things behind paywalls. My general sense at the moment, however, is that most podcasting is free, and that even paywalled things tend to kind of either leak out by the creators, or the creators creating versions that everybody can hear, and then there is just a little bit of extra that you can pay for. So I my sense is that at the moment, podcast is stronger as a free access medium. And I think that podcast creators and the industry are aware, maybe. I could be very wrong, but that is just my sense. I'm not seeing very successful attempts for paywalled access. What do you guys think? Is my sense correct?
I'm on a big learning curve at the moment around platforms and access, and having just put two podcasts, one more to come, up, and all and looking at how we market the Rebel Women of Sunderland podcast so that as many people can listen to it as possible. And what, of course, is fascinating is that we can see exactly how many people are downloading and how long they're staying to listen within the length of the podcast, and where they're listening. And we are also becoming aware of really neat, this is probably very old media for some people, but using QR codes, for instance, so that, and having a postcard with a QR code or putting QR codes out around, and actually that people beginning to, you know, access things on that. So I think that that there's a lot of learning about how you actually maximize the audiences for your podcast, whether they're local audiences or broader audiences, and how you, there's some big questions in the industry, I think, about monetization of podcasts, how you can sustain podcasts over a longer period. There's quite a lot of single podcasts by enthusiasts, but, you know, unless it is a voluntary community sort of activity, you know, you need to keep it out there and keep marketing. And you're very lucky if something goes viral, you know, straight away. And we're quite keen to having Pump Prime, the podcast at the university, to then, you know, have some independent funding for it. So we're sort of looking at ways of doing that. And I think there seems, I mean, this is just really basic stuff around, you know, whether you have sponsorship and ads and things like that in podcasts. There seems to be a bit more tolerance for ads in podcasts than frequent ads in a commercial radio hour, for instance. But I don't know. I'm an amateur in this compared to some of my colleagues, so I'd probably better not talk about that. But it is really interesting as a producer, and, you know, wanting that podcast to get as much, you know, airtime and reviews and things like that as possible. It's really interesting to sort of think through what works and what doesn't. And what is helping sustain that podcast over a longer period, so that we can pay our producers who are graduates, and we want to pay them, we want to be able to fund good quality podcasts, and not have it as just a one-off thing. So,
well, and that's the end. I mean, then circling back, I do feel like I'm banging on the scheduled radio station paradigm here, but it is the thing where you have a station and you have a scheduled show. You have the regularity of that, you have the familiarity of that, and so, and I was listening to a bit of the Rebel Women before coming on today, Caroline, and you have set it up as a series, you know, because that's the other challenge for podcasts, right? Is to maintain that momentum, you know. And there's probably all, you know, I can imagine from what you guys are saying, there's this tension between retaining the integrity of what you need to do with the podcast, you know, what it aims to do, and the challenge presented by any kind of advertising who might set conditions, for example. But it's also interesting in the bigger picture to think about those structural concerns, you know, because if you're looking at radio, you look at those institutional concerns and policy and remits and regulations. So podcasting, of course, still has to carry its own affordances and its own questions around how to maintain that. So I can hear you guys navigating that, you know, that new world. So, yeah, I guess, I don't know, any final words on future? We've talked about futures already. I don't know where we go from that.
For me, I'm really interested in bringing in some of the, not losing some of the sort of legacy, the heritage, the practices, the good practices, the best practices of community radio, and not, and helping to transfer some of that into community made, participatory made podcasts, and that's what's sort of concerning me at the moment, that actually setting up some of the good structures and infrastructures around these things in terms of the methods you use to involve people, the production values, you know, thinking through some of that. We haven't really talked about that. And but fundamentally, seeing this podcast space as a place where new voices can be heard, and I do not want the podcast space for to be dominated by the Joe Rogans. You know, obviously, I'm trying. I'm in the same way that. Yeah, so I'm very keen for to explore and to explore the ways that we can make podcasts with communities in different ways.
Yeah, I think community is probably inherent in podcasting because it sort of lives on the internet where comment sections live. Of course, there's a lot of conflict there as well, but I think that's another difference in terms of if you're asking Katie about sort of broadcast radio and podcasting, you can have communities around live radio, obviously, but the discussion between these people might not be as instant, maybe. As it can be in podcasts. So I think that's another reason why that's a good space, I think, for community, Caroline. I remain very interested in the intimate connections that can be created through audio content. I think some of them are very similar to what we've seen so far with broadcast radio, and some of them are emerging as quite different. But I am very happy to see how well podcasting is doing. There's always that perception. I have people coming to me often say, oh, look, podcasting is going up and so good, for your people. And I say that radio itself has always been seen as the medium in peril. It's always something, we're going to lose it or whatever, but it never, it's like our beloved Guy Stark, he said, it is a very resilient medium. And I think podcasting is part of that story.
I couldn't say it better myself. I feel like there's a repurposing of liveness too that you're describing, which is a nice, which makes my adherence and love for live radio, it reassures me, because yes, you're right, to reply in real time, to be able to participate in these listening communities in real time is so valuable. And so repurposing that through podcasting ensures that liveness, still has a place in terms of this, how we access and experience this medium. Thank you, everybody. This is very generative.
Thank you.
I actually feel like we've opened up things and could talk about this further. But so stopping feels a little artificial, but this has been so interesting. I appreciate you guys.
I appreciate you. Thank you so much for the opportunity.